waving in the wind. Dull through the leafless trees, he heard the voice of the north. Sorrow revived in his soul. He began and lamented the dead.
How hast thou fallen like an oak with all thy branches round thee? Where is Fingal the king? Where is Oscar my son? Where are all my race? Alas, in earth they lie. I feel their tombs with my hands. I hear the river below murmuring hoarsely over the stones. What dost thou, O river, to me? Thou bringest back the memory of the past.
David, thank you. Fiona, you can almost hear the swirl of music as well as that river under the voice of the bard Ossian. It's from James Macpherson's Fragments of Ancient Poetry. And Beethoven was actually one of those who was caught up in this cult of Ossian that really swept the continent in the 18th century, wasn't he?
That's right. He writes a letter in 1809, actually, saying he wants to read the poetry of Goethe and Schiller, who are modern German writers, but also Homer and Ossian, because those are his favourites.
And what's the impetus behind it? Why is Macpherson writing this?
That's quite a long story, so I'll make it fairly brief. Macpherson was a Highlander. He grew up in the Scottish Highlands. He witnessed as a child the 45 Rebellion and its aftermath, and he also saw that the Gaelic culture that he'd been brought up with, his native culture, was disappearing. So part of what he was doing with the Ossian poems was trying to preserve what he saw as the fragments of this ancient culture, though he was actually being quite creative with his translations.
How creative was he, Robert?
Very. That's what makes him such a powerful imagination. That's why he had such an impact on European Romanticism. On the one hand, he was saying, here's stuff I've brought you from Gaelic, from this strange primitive language spoken only in the mountains of the far north. And yet, on the other hand, the stuff sounded decorous and polite and alluring, and you could read it in your Edinburgh drawing room while you were all nice and warm. So it was, on the one hand, a kind of savage music, and on the other hand, it was absolutely noble and quite usable in polite society. That fitted the romantic imagination.
Because in some sense, it was a fake, wasn't it? There's an interesting thought, these Edinburgh people sitting in their drawing rooms, being able to feel that they can be that romantic individual. And there's a sense in which with the Goethe and the Schiller, with Goethe's Sorrows of Young Werther, for example, you really see the individual and their experience being put at the heart of what they're doing. Do you think that's true of Scottish romantics as well? Do you think it's true of Macpherson?
No. I think Scottish Romanticism isn't so much about individualism, it's much more about a sense of community. And that's quite strong in the poetry of Ossian. Even although Ossian is a kind of last survivor of a race that has gone and so feeds into the melancholy that's often part of the romantic imagination, nonetheless, he's a voice of a community. He's a bard. Robert Burns is a poet of his people. He is, again, bardic. What's wonderful about Scots writing is it's not just about the individual, it's about kinds of community.
And there's a real challenge to the social hierarchies of the time, isn't there? Somebody like Burns, does he seriously challenge the social hierarchies?
I think he does, but at the same time in a quite unthreatening way. This is the thing with Burns, like Macpherson. He appeals to people at all different levels, and different people respond in different ways.
Well, let's hear a bit of one of the great Burns challenges to social hierarchy.
Man's a man for all that. Is there for honest poverty that hangs his head, deny that? The coward slave, we pass him by. We dare be poor for all that and all that. Our toils obscure and all that. The rank is but the guinea's stamp. The man's the gowd for all that. What though in homely fare we dine, wear hodden grey and all that, gie fools their silks and knaves their wine, a man's a man for all that and all that, their tinsel show and all that, the honest man, though e'er sae poor, is king of men for all that. You see on Birkie, cried a lord, with struts and stairs and all that, though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coof for all that and all that, his ribbon star and all that, the man of independent mind, he looks and laughs at all that. A prince can make a belted knight, a marquis, duke and all that, but an honest man's a boon his might. Get faith, he manna for all that and all that, their dignities and all that. The pith o' sense and pride o' worth are higher rank than all that. Then let us pray that come it may, as come it will, for all that, that sense and worth o'er all the earth shall bear the gree and all that, for all that and all that, it's coming yet, for all that, that man to man the world o'er shall brothers be, for all that.
I love that change from anger to hope at the end there. I think that's very Beethovenian, actually, from struggle into the kind of, in the minor, into the major key. It's a very interesting one. Robert, that's radical. Man to man, the world o'er, shall brothers be for all that.
Yes.
That's the international.
Yes.
How does that fit in with the Romantic project?
Well, that's what you might set beside Beethoven's use of Schiller's Ode to Joy and that ideal of universal brotherhood. Which is coming out, in for Burns, it's coming from things like the American Revolution, the French Revolution. There's a radical Republican side to Burns. But it's bound up with other things too, such as Freemasonry. Burns was a Freemason, so he was very keen on brotherhood and funny handshakes and all this kind of thing. There are different streams feeding into this notion of brotherhood, but one of them is certainly that of liberté, égalité, fraternité.
And do you think the use of Scott's vernacular is actually part of that radicalism?
Yes, it's people. You shouldn't get too hung up on the fact that it's Scott's. More important, the fact it's vernacular, it's popular language, it's being able to articulate political and other ideals using the voice of the people and fusing the poet's voice with a popular voice. Burns does that perhaps to a greater extent than almost any other poet, certainly in the English language.
And do you think you can recognise the same thing, Fiona, in early Wordsworth, in Coleridge, in the attempt to find a vernacular that speaks to people?
Yes, and I think Wordsworth and Coleridge were very influenced by Burns, actually, when Wordsworth's talking about writing a new kind of poetry. And what is a poet? He's a man speaking to men. He's almost quoting Burns there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Though Wordsworth loses the dialect, interestingly. The problem, perhaps, with Wordsworth is that he's gone to Cambridge. Burns is someone who never went to university. I was rather wary of universities. So in a way, I think Burns turns that into a strength. Wordsworth's language is magnificent, totally humorless, but magnificent. Burns, who has a great sense of humor, feeds that through the vernacular. Wordsworth tends almost never to use dialect words, which would have been native to him where he grew up in the north of England, but they've somehow been combed out and purified.
Actually, he does sometimes use dialect words.
It's not very often.
But not as often as Burns. No, that's perfectly true.
Now, Fiona, you've chosen to look at a passage about another sort of bard for David to read, a passage from Sir Walter Scott's historical novel Redgauntlet, which I think, illustrates the affinity between another form of vernacular, folk music, and the romantic vision. Perhaps you'd like to say a few words about it before David reads.
It's part of a letter written by the hero of the novel, Darcy Latimer, to his rather more straight-laced friend, Alan Fairford, who's a lawyer in Edinburgh. And Darcy's telling him about his adventures as he travels south in search of his identity. He knows he's an Englishman, and he's wanting to cross the Solway. But it's quite interesting that as he makes his journey, not very successfully, Scott has him encounter this old blind fiddler called Wandering Willie.
David.
I asked him if he was of this country. "This country," replied the blind man. "I am of every country in broad Scotland, and a wee bit of England to the boot. But yet I am in some sense of this country, for I was born within hearing of the roar of Solway. Will I give your honour a touch of the old breadwinner?" He preluded as he spoke in a manner which really excited my curiosity, and then taking the old tune of Gala Shields for his theme, he graced it with a number of wild, complicated, and beautiful variations, during which it was wonderful to observe how his sightless face was lighted up under the conscious pride and heartfelt delight in the exercise of his own very considerable powers. "What think ye of that now, for 80?" I expressed my surprise and pleasure. "A rant, man, an old rant," said Willie. "Nothing like the music ye hae in your ballhouses and your playhouses in Edinburgh, but it's Whalen Uch hencing away to Dykeside. Here's another. It's no Scotch tune, but it passes for ain. Oswald made it himself, I reckon. He has cheated money in, but he canna cheat Wandering Willie." He then played your favourite air of Rosalind Castle, with a number of beautiful variations, some of which I'm certain were almost extempore.
Thank you, David, as Wandering Willie. Tonight's prom picks up on this romantic interest in traditional popular music. There are bubbles of Scottish reel coming up right through Macmillan's Violin Concerto, and that seems to fit with a contemporary exploration of tradition now. But why, Robert, is it attractive to 18th century composers?
I think Beethoven clearly was interested in folk music from a number of countries, partly because there was money in it, but also I think there was to some degree an interest in bringing popular elements into his music. But Beethoven's settings of Burns, for instance, are often regarded as rather uneasy. They're not maybe as full-blooded as some of Beethoven's other music. If you think of Beethoven's setting of Auld Lang Syne, I'm going to be rude here. If you could imagine a Burns who had published his poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect and had a big success with these in 1787 and then moved to a Bijou flat in Kensington, then Beethoven's setting of Auld Lang Syne sounds a bit like the Burns in the Bijou flat in Kensington. It's not quite right. It's interesting, but it's just the acoustic is funny.
I mean, I think as well it must have been quite difficult for Beethoven in Vienna making these arrangements of Scottish tunes. It must have all seemed, you know, slightly at one remove.
He didn't know English, I think, Beethoven, and didn't know Scots. So he got some German translations, which sometimes people say were not all that great, to work from. Mm. So there's a kind of uneasiness, I think, that comes through sometimes in the music.
One romantic theme that we've skimmed over so far is the feeling for landscape. It's very noticeable in Ossian. It's very noticeable there in Red Gauntlet. And you've chosen a poem to hear next that illustrates it perfectly, but it's by an author who's not commonly associated with Scottish romantics. Lord Byron. Explain yourself.
Well, this is George Gordon, Lord Byron, who described himself once as born half a Scot and bred a whole one. He said that because he was taken to Aberdeenshire at the age of 2, and he spent the next 8 years there. So if you think, how much do you remember from before you were 2, I suspect the answer is not very much at all. So most of Byron's early childhood memories were Scottish ones, and he was, in one part of his imagination, formed by the experience of being in Aberdeenshire. And so much of his poetry is about displacement, a constant theme in Childe Harold, in Don Juan. He was a displaced person. He was a kid who, at the age of 10, was taken from Aberdeen Grammar School and sent to Harrow, and then it just got more complicated from then on. Terrible. He was abused as a child in Aberdeenshire. It wasn't very much fun for him there in some ways. But nonetheless, he writes these poems. There's one that starts, "When I roved a young Highlander." You know, this is not the way people think of Byron, but it was the way Byron thought of Byron, in some moods at least.
And perhaps explain some of the darkness that we find in poems like the one that David is going to read us. Would you read us the last stanza of Byron's Loch na Garr?
"Years have rolled on, Loch na Garr, since I left you. Years must elapse ere I tread you again. Nature of verdure and flowers has bereft you, yet still are you dearer than Albion's plain. England, thy beauties are tame and domestic to one who has roved o'er mountains afar. Oh, for the crags that are wild and majestic, the steep frowning glories of dark Loch na Garr."
That really is the Byron of wild and romantic landscapes, isn't it? It's interesting to me that if you cross the channel, Byron is remembered as the greatest of the British romantic poets and remembered as a political poet. It's
yes,
a much more political sense of romanticism.
So important to Pushkin and to Lermontov. But I think there's also it's a question of tonality. You know, when Ezra Pound says that Ossian is what starts the romantic movement, it's surely the tonality of Ossian he means. And when you hear the last line that David read there about the frowning glories of dark Loch na Garr, you know, it's a wonderfully rotacistic music that's there. I don't know how much Byron did roll his R sounds when he spoke, but that last line sounds very good in a Scottish accent.
It's all very male, isn't it, Fiona? Are there any Scottish romanticists who are female?
Scottish romantic women poets are very thin on the ground, I'm afraid to say.
Why?
Or they're really unfashionable. They've faded away. You know, people like Joanna Baillie. Nobody reads Joanna Baillie now.
Tell us about Joanna Baillie. Who's Joanna Baillie?
Well, in her own, a Scottish playwright and poet of the romantic era, much admired, friend of Scott, but she's almost, you know, gone down that like the Titanic. Carolina Oliphant, Lady Nairn, a great songwriter, but unfortunately someone who lived at roughly the same time as Mr. Burns, so eclipsed.
Yes, that's true, and Anne Grant of Laggan as well, another, you know, lady of letters, very well known at the time, but not so much now.
Susan Ferrier, sometimes seen, possibly annoyingly, but with some justice, as a kind of Scottish Jane Austen, writes about the Highlands. You know, just as Jane Austen produces a kind of critique of romantic culture, she talks about Highland landscape in terms of its raw turnip fields, you know, and she's obviously doing that to rather mock perceptions of what noble wild Highland landscape might be like.
That is all we have time for this evening. Thanks again to Fiona Stafford and Robert Crawford, and to our reader David Rintoul. Thank you very much.
Susan Hitch presented Proms Plus, recorded across the road at the Royal College of Music a little earlier this evening. The producer was Zahid Worley. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back live to the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra back on stage, giving their first prom of the season. Busy weekend for them and their chief conductor, Donald Runnicles. Tomorrow at 6, the Proms Wagner Bicentenary celebrations continue with Tannhäuser. Donald Runner calls an acclaimed Wagnerian. He was saying earlier what he sees as the influence Beethoven had on Wagner, particularly the Fifth Symphony, which we're going to hear in about 10 minutes' time. Runner says it's difficult when performing the Fifth not to think of the sheer ubiquity of the work.
Yes, the Fifth Symphony is very popular with many people. No doubt there are people who only know the first six bars or whatever. But my approach to this is like many others. I try to, when I come back to it each time, I try to discover what's going on in this man's head. And there's not a lot of indication in the score of rubati or ways in which you can interpret phrasings differently. And I just feel very humbled by the work. And I'm very humbled every time I perform it. All I feel is, if am I living up to what this work gives us? Am I living up to Beethoven's expectation in this? Anybody who would approach it in terms of I wish to interpret it differently, I think runs the risk of hubris. Just do what's there. That's the hardest thing.
Well, we'll hear Donald Runicles conducting the Fifth Symphony immediately after Beethoven's Coriolan Overture, written for an 1807 production of a play by Heinrich von Collin, the same story as Shakespeare's Coriolanus, concerning a Roman hero who, when banished, joins the enemy and threatens Rome. Confronted by pleas from his mother and his wife, he breaks down and kills himself. The impassioned story and the stirring drama of von Collin's play incorporated very much by Beethoven in his overture, one of his most intense expressions of raw emotion. So the stage is set, curtains just being drawn shut over the doors at the top of the steps. Donald Runicles once again energetically strides onto the platform to conduct the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra Beethoven's Coriolan Overture.
Thank you. Thank you. Donald Runicles, chief conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducting Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And before it, we heard the Coriolan Overture. He bows from the rostrum. Turns now to face the orchestra, walks off stage. Beethoven's Fifth in C minor, but the last movement emphatically in C major. As Beethoven once wrote, many assert that every minor piece must end in the minor. On the contrary, I find that the major has a glorious effect. Joy follows sorrow just as sunshine follows rain. It affects me as if I were looking up to the silvery glistening of the evening star. Principal Oboist Stella McCracken, Principal Flautist Rosemary Elliott taking a bow. Bassoonist Julian Roberts. Principal Horn David Flack. And the woodwind section en masse on feet now, on their feet, brass following them. Well, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra back later in the season. Matthias Pinscher conducting the Firebird and his new double trumpet concerto. And Ilon Volkov will conduct a great programme, including the premiere of Frederick Jevsky's piano concerto. Those concerts on the 18th and 19th of August. Before that, there's Tannhäuser tomorrow at 6, the appearance of the choir of the Deutsche Oper, of which Runicles is music director, eagerly awaited. And, of course, the BBC Scottish have an extra busy summer because they appear at the Edinburgh Festival as well. Next weekend, Ilon Volkov conducts Berio's Symphonia and Runicles will conduct Verdi's Requiem on the 31st of August. Donald Runicles returning to the platform again now. I suspect an early night tonight for him and the orchestra ahead of a mammoth night of Wagner tomorrow, 6 o'clock here on Radio 3. As he takes a bow, brings the leader of the orchestra, Laura Samuel, to her feet. Now the entire bandstand from a packed Royal Albert Hall. Very good night to you, and back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you very much. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, every prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. And there's more Beethoven live from the Royal Albert Hall here on Radio 3 this coming Thursday night.
After an absence of almost 20 years, piano soloist Mitsuko Uchida returns to the BBC Proms, playing Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in the first of two BBC Proms concerts given by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor Maris Janssens. A pair of concerts culminating with Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, on Friday. Join me, Christopher Cook, for the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra at the Proms on BBC Radio 3, Thursday night from 7 o'clock.
We're back to this evening, and in around 18 minutes' time, our feature, Christine Finn, excavates clues in the personal and public life of the once-acclaimed archaeologist and writer Jacatta Hawkes to explain why she's faded from public memory. That's at 9:45 tonight. And followed on by Here and Now, our look at the world of contemporary music, taking a look back tonight to the many musical worlds of Karlheinz Stockhausen. That's at 10:30. For the moment, music by 17-year-old Rachmaninoff, written in just a couple of days in January 1891. This is his Russian Rhapsody for two pianos, played by Andrei Previn and Vladimir Ashkenazy.
Thank you.
the teenage Rachmaninoff's Russian Rhapsody in E minor for two pianos. It was played there by Andrei Previn and Vladimir Ashkenazy. Well, tomorrow night here on Radio 3, live from the Proms, Wagner's Tannhäuser. And this is another Wagner hero, Siegfried, in the forest, trying to communicate with the forest birds, one of which finally tells him the way to find Brünnhilde. And this has to be one of the most unlikely Wagner arrangements ever made, or at least made for that most unlikely of Wagnerian instruments, the harmonium. It's a small portable organ, and the results could sound like a grim or faintly comic parody. That they don't says something about the arranger here, a man who knew his keyboards and especially his organ family better than most, Karg Eilert, whose first name, by happy coincidence, was Siegfried. The Forest Murmurs from Wagner's Siegfried, arranged for the harmonium by Siegfried Karg-Ehlert and played there by Johannes Matthias Michael. And there's more Wagner from the Proms tomorrow night, a concert performance of Tannhäuser. Last weekend's superb Tristan, Robert Dean Smith, is the errant knight of the title, with Donald Runicles conducting, and that's live from the Royal Albert Hall here on Radio 3, starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. Back to this evening, it's a little after a quarter to ten, and now on Radio 3, tonight's feature. In her day, the archaeologist Jacquetta Hawkes was a leading public figure. Yet, until her most famous book was reprinted last year, it seemed that she'd been forgotten. Well, we join fellow archaeologist and writer Christine Finn on a mission to discover who Jacquetta was and the reason she disappeared, beginning on a warm evening May in the heart of Wharfdale in Yorkshire.
The churchyard of St Michael's in Haberholm, in the Yorkshire Dales, is an idyllic place to be on a perfect summer's evening. Inside the church is a memorial to one of the best-known literary figures of the 20th century, J.B. Priestley. His ashes were buried nearby by his third wife, Jacquetta Hawkes. She died 12 years later, in 1996, and her ashes are also nearby. It's been my quest since finding a hoard of her papers and manuscripts after her death to discover why a woman who was so influential in her time as an archaeologist, author, nature lover, and central to the rebuilding of post-war Britain should have been forgotten while Priestley's name remains well known today. I'm here to start a literary excavation which I'm hoping will end up with Jacquetta Hawkes being recognised once again as one of the key figures in post-war British culture.
To the south and the east, there are the lowlands. Young, soft, extroverted, and always very easily accessible.
What she taught us and what we're rediscovering in many ways is the importance of the big narrative, the long-durée narrative of humanity and the landscape in which humanity has always lived and worked.
Then, in the north and the west, there are the highlands, which are built of the ancient hard rocks, very hard, introverted, and relatively inaccessible. Not very many people live among the higher mountains.
She's actually really much more than an archaeologist. She has, I think, a refined, sophisticated, very recognisable, individual voice that speaks of the connections between the past and the present.
Look and see where they are prepared to shift most stone and soil. That is where a people's heart really lies.
Basically, it's history through material remains, and the task was the same, to recreate the story of mankind from periods before writing.
The Celts made their round houses, rather as a bird builds its nest. They made their tracks and their field walls curving in and out with the hill and the valley.
She was an archaeologist, and that informs everything she did, but she was able to make it accessible to everybody because she had a very strong visual sense, a very strong imagination, and she could respond to people in the past as people. She could feel a sense of kinship with them.
The Romans imposed an intellectual pattern on what had been the spontaneous, unthought-out pattern of prehistoric and Celtic life. They drove their roads as straight as thought.
She actually sees that the development of Britain has been a gradual thing. Just as different strata reacted on each other, so different people did. We see the cultures much more melding together.
The houses were square and they stood out against this rolling, curving substance of the prehistoric world.
She could take an approach which looks to unclutter things and turn it into something which people could very, very much relate to. This sense of place in England, the depth of history in the land itself, a kind of notion that in this intimate engagement with what's left of the past, we can explore what it is that happened here that makes us who we are now, what has become of what was in this land of ours.
I thought about these hidden depths as I sat in the peace of St Michael's Churchyard and reread my copy of A Land, the book that had first brought me to Jacquetta Hawkes. Her description of the Yorkshire Dales, written more than 60 years earlier, perfectly described what lay before me now.
The late sunlight is flowing down the valley, and seems at once to magnify and mellow every feature of the scene. The walls, built by hands, with millions of fragments from the limestone hills, seem a calm assertion of the labour of generations. Every stone, with its own immense history held in it, has been handled, judged, given its chink, to fill a plan seen not on paper, but freely in the builder's mind.
When I drove away from Hubberholm the following morning, a young man was repairing a dry stone wall, handling some of those fragments of limestone, his hands touching the past. It reminded me that Jagetta was, essentially, a romantic archaeologist. She brought dead stones to life with the power of her words, chiming with my own feelings that archaeology is more than simply quantifying artefacts. I first came across the name Jagetta Hawkes shortly before she died in 1996. I was researching how archaeology had influenced poetry. I wondered if the reverse was true. Did poetry come out of digging? Her book, A Land, published in 1951, had been an award-winning bestseller, but out of print for years. In it, I found an extraordinary synthesis of archaeology and poetry, geology and art, all set in the context of a journey which began as she lay in her garden in North London.
When I have been working late on a summer night, I like to go and lie on the patch of grass in our back garden. This garden is a square of about 20 feet, so that to lie in it is like exposing oneself in an open box or tray. Not far below the topsoil is the London clay, which, as Primrose Hill, humps up conspicuously at the end of the road. This hard ground presses my flesh against my bones and makes me agreeably conscious of my body. In bed I can sleep. Here I can rest awake. Dear Mrs. Hawkes, I've only read halfway through your book, A Land, but I can't wait to tell you how much my husband and I are enjoying it. To discover such amazingly interesting facts about the earth and to have one's own small span of life shrink to its proper proportion is enough in itself, but to read about it in a lovely mixture of prose and poetry is more than enough.
People did seem to respond in an extraordinary way to A Land, people who are not archaeologists, and it can be read really as a work of poetry, don't you think?
One of the things I love about it is the fact that she introduces poetry. A lot of the writing is very poetic.
The Roman archaeologist Martin Hennig is a colleague with whom I shared my discovery of A Land. It turned out that the book had been part of his childhood. His father had loved it. 1951, the year A Land was published, was also the year of the Festival of Britain, an extravaganza designed to connect Britain's heroic past with its future. And Jagetta Hawkes was the festival's archaeology advisor.
Well, you may remember the old South Bank with its muddle of mean streets and dingy wharves. Well, all's been swept away, and in its place, we've got now this shining new architectural vision of the future. Right in the centre of that sequence is this breathtaking centrepiece, the Dome of Discovery, the largest dome in the whole world. It's
more than 60 years after the Festival of Britain, I'm on the South Bank in London, trying to understand a bit more about the exhibition that Jagetta put together called The Land, which came about the same time as she was working on the book, A Land. Martin Hennig was one of those people who flocked to the South Bank. Martin, can you describe what it was like for you as a small child coming here and trying to understand the landscape of Britain through Jagetta's work?
It was magic. The building I remember most was something called the Dome of Discovery, which seemed to encapsulate everything, science, animals, which I love, and archaeology.
This is the place, I think, that really is going to take most of the visitors' breath away.
I've already visited some sites with my father. Amongst them, I remember very vividly Stonehenge. And this was an exhibition which really brought them all to life. I remember particularly some little models of life in different eras of the past.
August the 23rd, 1949. Dear Jagetta, as you say, the question of prehistoric clothes in Britain is the very devil. As to the Neolithic costume, I'm pretty convinced that we must accept a total lack of evidence for spinning and weaving. Assume, therefore, that they wore skins and leather garments of various kinds. If you make your Mesolithic chaps furry, as I think you should, I suppose the Neolithic ones should look a bit less like Eskimos. More than that I cannot say, and as you know, there's no evidence anyway.
That was a letter from another eminent archaeologist, Stuart Piggott. It was part of the hoard I uncovered after Jaquetta's death. For me, A Land was such a remarkable book that I was puzzled as to why it had been out of print so long. So I began my own dig into her past after visiting Jaquetta's last home in the Cotswolds, invited by her close friend Diana Collins. I spent 3 days there cataloguing her books and, moved by the fragments of writing I was unearthing, suggested to her son Nicholas, who lived elsewhere, that I might write her biography. He agreed. The housekeeper thought I might be interested in an array of cobwebbed tea chests, dusty boxes, and two crammed filing cabinets. A motley assemblage, and apparently headed for the tip. I rescued the lot. 16 years later, I drove from Hubberholm to Ilkley to talk with Nicholas about that find.
I was at the time, after all, my mother had just died, I was quite overwhelmed. I was at the time not really aware of the records that existed. She was not a very systematic person about records. And I thought that the cabinet where you so excitingly discovered so much of the record, I thought it was just full of household management papers. But I myself am a hoarder and keeper and classifier. So I was delighted when your forthright exploration produced such lovely results.
Far from household ephemera, this was a literary treasure trove. After travelling around with me for several years, the precious papers eventually found a fitting home alongside Priestley's archive in Bradford.
I'm Alison Cullingford. I'm Special Collections Librarian at Bradford University, and among the 100 collections we care for is the papers of Jaquetta Hawkes, which are my personal favourite.
Dear Mrs. Hawkes, hope you will not mind me writing to tell you how thoroughly I've enjoyed reading A Land. And these are from general members of the public, who of course would have come to her also through the Festival of Britain.
Yes.
And the work she did there.
And she got the OBE for it, which I think, having looked at the correspondence, I think she deserved it because it was hard work.
She gave people a great experience, didn't she, of almost going into an excavation trench and feeling what it was like to be underground with all these objects just hanging there in space almost.
I mean, we've got this file here which is all about the Festival of Britain. It's all the correspondence over, I think, 4 or 5 years of getting the thing together. There's all sorts of official documents, committee meetings, confidential, and then there's lots of correspondence where she tries to find out more about, you know, what harness should somebody be wearing, and then there's what can be done, you know, how can you convey what you want to convey within whatever parameters you've got. There's a lot of discussion about what size the figures should be, because obviously they don't want people to think that the people then are pygmies. She's just said that there. I think they wanted her because she was an expert, but she was an expert who was good at making things accessible and knew how to work with the civil service, how to work with government departments.
And she was working with artists and other writers and poets.
As an archive, it's incredibly rich. It's full of unpublished writings and it's full of her contacts with other people. So there's an immense amount of scholarship there for archaeology, for poetry, for literature. I mean, the whole sort of intellectual life, artistic life of the mid-20th century is there, really.
Jaquetta was an archaeologist, but she was also a published poet and playwright. She corresponded with key figures in the arts, Robert Graves, T.S. Eliot, Ben Nicholson, Laurie Lee. Henry Moore was a good friend.
It is hardly possible to express in prose the extraordinary awareness of the unity of past and present, of mind and matter, of man and man's origin. Once, when I was at Moore's studio and saw one of his reclining figures, with the shaft of a belemnite exposed in the thigh, my vision of this unity was overwhelming.
She asked him to illustrate A Land because she was captivated by the idea of his sculptural forms emerging from the stone as if they were there already, and he merely was the agent of their release.